You are now listening to the Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to New World Pictures Podcast, where we'll talk about all the movies released by New World Pictures. I'm Ryan. With me, as always, is Mark.
I'm Mark.
And Erica is on assignment. And we have an incredible interview for you today. Stephen Kostanski, an incredible filmmaker. He, obviously, we all got into, we talked about on this podcast a long time ago. We talked about Psycho Goreman, which we fell in love with. But all the Astron 6 stuff. We've gotten into Mark and I are huge fans of The Editor. Frankie Frico was one of my favorite movies of last year. And he comes out with Deathstalker. I mean, I could not believe our luck that he was going to make this movie. If anybody should make a Deathstalker, it's Stephen Kostanski.
When you texted me a few weeks ago and said there's a remake of Deathstalker.
Right.
I kid you not. I was in the middle of working. I dropped everything and just started diving in. Who made this?
Right.
Why did someone remake Deathstalker of all the movies of the sword and sandal genre? Why that one? Then when I found out that Stephen Kostanski was behind it, I was like, oh, this is going to be incredible. It was an immediate buy for me.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Last week's episode, for those of you who listened, we talked about it. And we're fortunate enough to be able to have talked with Stephen about the movie, about his other movies, about Astron 6. Stephen, an incredible guy. We have to thank him for his time and availability. So excited to have him on the show. Let's just go ahead and go get right to it. Here's
let's
us.
Do it.
Let's do it. Here's
why
us
are we talking? We shouldn't talk anymore.
People don't care about us. People don't care. They're like,
never have, never will.
Shut up. We don't care what you guys have to say. Get to Stephen. Here we are talking to Stephen Kostanski. Do want to say congratulations on Deathstalker. We cannot tell you how excited we were that you were the one to make a new Deathstalker movie, because I feel like this, if anyone was going to make it, it was great that it was you, because I felt like this is a movie that's perfectly suited to your sensibilities.
Yeah, in a weird roundabout sort of way, it is. Maybe not necessarily on paper if you just like watch that franchise start to finish, but I think just in a broader context of wanting to make like an epic fantasy adventure that had a lot of flavor of not just Deathstalker, but like fantasy movies in general. That was the task I was definitely up for. I'm sure watching the movie, you clock that, you know, there's a lot more than Deathstalker. There's a lot of Krull. There's a lot of Sword and the Sorcerer. There's a lot of Conquest. There's kind of all of it mashed in there.
Yeah, so, Conquest, one of my absolute favorites. I love that movie. But did you see all the Deathstalker movies? You've seen them all, right?
Oh, yeah. I had been a fan like for years before this even became an option. And really what happened was I was presented with a list of Corman properties from, is it like New Horizons, I think, was the label.
Yes.
Shout Factory bought that catalog.
Right.
And I was presented with a list of titles, and you know, there's a lot of fun stuff on there, but I just went right down to D and saw Deathstalker and was like, I want to make a fantasy movie, like a sword and sorcery movie. It would be fun to, in a weird way, like come full circle, because in the early days of Astron 6, we actually made a series of short films called Goreblade that were parodies of Deathstalker. And so it only made sense to try at some point in my career tackle that franchise. So it all things lined up almost way too well for this project to come together. It was kind of crazy, actually.
It did take a little bit of time, though, right? Didn't you get this idea or get the opportunity for Deathstalker, and then you had time in between? Didn't you make Frankie Frico in between?
Yeah, like the conversation for this started while I was still making Psycho Goreman. Like I was in post-production on that when I saw this list, and I picked Deathstalker and was like, hey, let's like get this conversation going. And then it was a lot of like ups and downs and starts and stops. And yeah, I just got like frustrated and was like, I just want to make a movie. So that's why I made Frankie Frico. Cause in my mind, you know, making a little monster movie would somehow be less work and be kind of like a fun in between thing to do, thinking like, oh, the monsters are one third the size of normal monsters, so therefore it's one third the work, which makes absolutely no sense in retrospect. So yeah, we did Frankie Frico and then dived right into Deathstalker, like as I was doing post-production on Frankie Frico. So it was a busy like couple of years, like 2023, 2024 were just kind of nonstop for me. So
did you go yeah. right from Frankie Frico into Deathstalker?
Yeah, like we were in pre-production on Deathstalker January of 2024, and we were doing post-production for Frankie Frico at the exact same time. So I would go back and forth between the effects shop making monsters for Deathstalker, and then I would go over to the post-production house and I would sit in on color grading sessions or the sound mix, or I'd be doing VFX in the evenings for Frankie Frico, doing like the last minute like straggler shots for the movie, like paint outs and things and eye blinks and stuff. So yeah, that those few months were a little insane, and I would not like to repeat that in my film career, but yeah, I survived. That's the important thing. I survived, and I think I got two pretty fun movies out of it.
Yeah, so. Certainly. And it's, you know, when the opportunity is there, you got to go for it, right?
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, especially after years of waiting for this thing to happen, I was definitely like cursing the heavens at the time that it timed out this way. But you have to take it. You're not going to be like, oh, let's wait another year because the, you know, the financing could fall through, the cast could fall through. There's a lot of moving parts that had to line up for this to work. So yeah, I just had to do it.
Oh, of course. Yeah. And you're on like a hell of a run. Like, I feel like Psycho Goreman and Frankie Frico and Deathstalker is like, you're on an incredible run. And it's amazing to see, because I got into Psycho Goreman, got into all the Astron 6 stuff and Manborg and all the stuff that you guys have done, not just you, but as a collective, The Void and everything else. And it's this feels like you're making movies that I couldn't see anyone else making but you, but you're also kind of seemingly at least making the kind of movies that you want to make, which in this environment is kind of amazing.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I can do that is because I'm making them for next to no money. Like,
sure,
it's a lot
sure.
of beg, borrow, stealing. And I mean, the life of a indie filmmaker is not a lucrative one. I can confirm that. I mean, I'm fortunate that I can work in prosthetic effects to pay the bills and feed my family. But yeah, like I make these movies because I just love making movies so much and I can't stop. Like, I'm addicted to it. You'd think I can recall after every single one of these movies being like, I need to stop for a bit. I need to take a break. And then like the next day I'm up and I'm like, oh, so the next movie, I got to do this and blah, blah, blah. It's like, I instantly forget the trauma of the previous movie.
Right.
And like, here I am doing the exact same thing, like writing and prepping upcoming stuff after, you know, Deathstalker. It was a tough project to pull off, and my most ambitious and easily my most like mentally crushing project, but I'm still just like, all right, on to the next thing. So I guess I just have some kind of a problem. I don't know.
Was Deathstalker more difficult than like The Void? I know you had talked about how difficult that one was to make.
Yeah, I mean, I always put The Void up on the pedestal as like the most insanely difficult thing I've ever done in my career. And I think Deathstalker is maybe on par, definitely times where it seemed like it was worse. But I don't know. Each one had its own hardships. It was just different levels of insanity that I was being subjected to. But at the same time, on both projects, wonderful people, like wonderful art, I think, came out of it. So yeah, I don't know. It's hard to say. I think because Deathstalker is so fresh, that's the one I'm going to be like, this was the hardest, most miserable thing ever. But
because it's the thing you just did most recently.
Yeah, exactly. But cut to a few years ago, and I still would have been saying The Void. So yeah, bottom line is making indie movies with any kind of ambition in Canada, especially navigating this pretty flawed system that we have to get movies made, and the people that unfortunately come along with that. It's just hard for everybody across the board. So
can you speak about that? About the process of getting a movie made right now, like currently, like how difficult is it to make things?
Very difficult. Cause it's like, if you want to make something for any kind of money, it's like, do you want to slot into the boxes that either like government funding or like studio financing want to slot you into, or do you want to make the thing that you're passionate about? And like, if those things don't connect, then you're off making movies for basically nothing. And also the reality, especially in Canada, is there's lots of people who say that they know how to produce movies. And I would argue that about 95% of those people don't. So right. Navigating that, not to say that there aren't wonderful people that I've worked with who definitely know what they're doing. But yeah, it's like, it's a tough industry because it's a lot of people. It's a lot of like fake it till you make it and a lot of shit rolling uphill that you have to navigate. So, I mean, the best thing you can do is just like find your people and stay with them. That's why I have a lot of like returning crew, like DOPs that I love, art teams that I love, my composers, Blitz Berlin, like they're just my guys at this point. I love working with those guys. We're connected, creatively in such a great way that I can just tell them, give them a very easy shorthand of what I'm looking for, and they can just expand upon what I want them to do, and always like exceeding my expectations in every way. So yeah, it's like you find the good people and you cling to those people. But the problem is also in this industry, when you have any kind of success, especially on like the producing or even like assistant directing or production managing side of things, they usually get swallowed up quickly because there's so many big shows shooting up here, big shows and movies and things. So it's like a lot of these good people get snapped up and then they're doing like, I don't know, The Boys season 5 or something, you know, like, and obviously you would go do that. You want to go get that sweet paycheck. Like, why would you stay in indie land and do that? So yeah, finding people in the indie world who want to make it fun, inventive genre stuff, and then like actually know what they're doing, or like a pretty hard thing, hard thing to find, and a tough thing to navigate in this landscape.
So you don't like independently finance though, and you're not really dealing with like tax rebates or anything. Like you seem to be working specifically with Raven Banner, or at least do they help fund the projects?
I mean, it's kind of all over the place. I mean, funding comes from different places. For Frankie Frico and Death Stalker, Shout Factory. Big shout out to Shout Factory for being awesome. Love working with them. And they were the ones who had this Corman list, and they're the ones who put up, basically they put up kind of initial financing that then in Canada you have to expand upon to build out your budget. And then that money that, like a Shout Factory or a Shutter or whoever puts in that, that's kind of just like the starting point, and then you have to expand upon that. It all gets very complicated and convoluted, and yeah, it's like a thing I'd love to not have to even think about that and just make the movies, and yet it's always something that I have to be discussing and debating, and it's part of this tug of war getting your movie made, of like enough money that you're not out on the street, but also not so much money that then you're just like wearing handcuffs the whole time, you know? So it's always a juggling act of financing, of crews, of just like trying to make this storm that is making a movie like work in your favor to get you like the best possible result. So yeah, it's a pretty exhausting thing to navigate.
And when you looked at that list that they gave you of like, the Concord New Horizon movies library that they had, was there anything that you just thought of for one split second before you decided on Deathstalker? I'm just curious.
I mean, honestly, that was the first one I just went right down to and was like, because when I were like Corman, I just started running through the list in my head before I even looked at it and was like, oh yeah, Deathstalker was like his Conan ripoff of the era. And yeah, big Deathstalker 2 fan over here, especially.
Of course,
so,
of course. The best one.
Yeah, so that was the one I went right down to.
Of the original four, let me just say.
Oh, yeah, yes, of course. Yeah, I mean, I would still put it at the top. And then, I mean, if people still make that one their number one, I'm fine with that. Because you can't, in my opinion, you can't top Jim Wynorski. I love that guy's movies. So influential to me. I mean, they should be teaching his stuff in film schools, I feel like, because he's such a master of like how to make make a scene fun. Like he just understands what fun is, and I think that is something that's been lost in especially this type of movie in modern filmmaking. So yeah.
Also, like, what's fun about listening to your commentaries on all the discs is that I have of your movies, you always talk about like having an element of stupid in your movies, which I adore, which I love. But I think Jim Wynorski has that too. You just have this, it's an element of fun that you want to have in there. And there's certain things that you want to just put in just because you find them fun. And it doesn't seem like a lot of people get to do that.
Well, because I feel like, I don't know, as like, technology advances and film advances, but also as audiences advances, it's like everybody's like too smart for their own good now when it comes to movies. Everyone's got a snarky comment or hot take on things, and like everybody's a critic, and so I feel like everyone's like scared to be stupid because they're worried that somehow people are gonna like look down on them for it. Like everyone wants to be the snooty prestige, elevated movie. And that's not what movies are to me. And I don't like that the concept of fun is said almost as like derogatory, like, oh, you're just making like a fun, like just like eat your popcorn and leave your brain at the door. Like, I don't get that shit. Like, that doesn't make sense to me because like the spectacle of movies is meant to be fun and exciting. And it always has been. And all the best movies are that. Like, to me, Ghostbusters is a perfect movie. That is a fun movie. Mm-hmm. There is so much fun. There's so much fun, and there's so much stupid. Like, there's so much people just being stupid. And is that so? Like, are you going to tell me that somehow is like you're going to dock it points because of that? I don't think so. I think that there's an art to silliness. There's an art to like bringing joy to people. And I don't think that it somehow is like a step below making some like, I don't know, grim, dark horror movie that's like, yeah, analyzing trauma or something, you know? Like, right, not to say that doesn't have a place, but I don't think it's a hierarchy. I think that you can have Hereditary on the shelf and you can have Ghoulies Go to College on the shelf. Right. And that's fine.
Right.
That is fine for me. Because the point, I want the broadest spectrum possible when I go into the video store. I don't want one thing.
Right. Yeah. And I was listening to Frankie Frico's commentary today, and you were talking about there's this shot where Connor, this is the most random bit, but of all the things that you've talked about that you kind of think are silly and stupid. But the thing where he's trying to put the picture of him and his wife back up on the wall, yes, and the picture keeps falling out. And like you had the longer shot of it, and it just kept falling out. And like, had you kept it, I was like, I would have been laughing so hard at that moment, just him constantly trying to put that picture on the wall. Like, but you have to fight for that.
But the moment we held on, I'm happy with. I think it does work.
Yes, it's 100%.
The beat, it has a punchline in its own way. But yeah, for the longest time, I had the whole take where it, yeah, eventually it landed on the picture frame hanging there. And then I think, yeah, it was like the picture like slid out, but just the frame was there. And yeah. Connor kind of like backs away like, okay, it's done. And it's like, I don't know. Yeah, it was like 30 seconds long in the middle of a montage. That doesn't make any sense. It doesn't. But yeah.
But it would have been, it's still such a funny idea. I can see it. And I'm like, it would have killed me just that. But I get why people were asking you to take it out, and it's got to be tough to fight for little things like that and go,
yeah. And I mean, also, like, in that movie at that point, like, it's I could see it being torturous for some people. Like, sure. I'm also trying to be sort of considerate to the guy that's maybe not fully on board this insanity. Right. And so you know, I don't, like, you know, you have to like carefully plan the symphony of a silly movie like that. And I just felt like at that point, that note was hitting maybe a little too hard and a little too prolonged. We needed, and I mean, it's pretty typical logic for like the last act of a movie. You kind of want to wrap things up. You don't want to have five different endings. You don't want to sit on something for too long. So it made sense to cut it. And I'm happy with the decision. I stand by it.
But sure, no, I get it. But I love that you have that commitment that you're still like, no, this moment deserves it, until you finally have to say, all right, I get that, you know, because the flow of the movie and the timing, we have to move on. But you still tried to like make it this great, you know, moment, because people like me would have totally appreciated it. But, you know, you have to still sort of make the movie, you know.
And also, like, to be fair, for me arguing for it, it's like, if there was ever a movie for me to have that moment, it's probably Frankie Frico, right? Like,
right.
I wouldn't do that in Deathstalker. I won't be doing that in like The Void or whatever. So,
right,
yeah, it that was the movie to experiment, to play around, and be like, how stupid is too stupid,
right?
And I feel like that moment was definitely a part where we're like, this is maybe too stupid. Let's dial it back.
Speaking of Deathstalker, did you shoot that all in the studio?
It was like kind of a 50-50 split. Like, there was location stuff. We shot in a big quarry up in Sudbury, Ontario, that had some real great vistas. Like, the opening battle scene was shot in this quarry. Some cliff stuff later on, Deathstalker and the swamp guy standing on the cliff. Like, that was all on location. But a lot of it was in studio, and we shot over like multiple blocks. So the second block was entirely studio stuff. So yeah, I mean, it informed the look of the movie that I was chasing, which was, and I've referenced this a few times to, you know, mostly confusion, but the live action Fist of the North Star movie from the 90s.
Sure. Tony Randall, Peter Atkins.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We talked to Tony and Peter about it. About Fist of the North Star. Yeah. Yeah. We had an interview with him, and I brought up a little bit of it because Chris Penn is kind of outrageous in that movie. And I had to have some questions about it, but yes. I totally get what you're saying.
So funny being familiar with that anime and seeing the actors they slot into those roles. Cause Chris Penn, he's the guy who has like the straps on his head. That's like holding his head together. It's insane that they're like, Chris Penn's the right guy for this. But that movie, like, what I love about it is the like inside as outside look is such a funny, weird aesthetic to me. Like the Mortal Kombat live action series, Mortal Kombat Conquest, is very much exists in that same kind of universe where it's like they're outside in a courtyard, but it's like, oh, that black space in the back is clearly where the studio, like the wall is.
Right.
And they've just blacked it out. And so I like that aesthetic. I feel like I grew up on it. It's just a language of more fantastical movies. And so I wanted that for Deathstalker. I was like, if I'm ever going to have an opportunity for this, it's this movie. So yeah, we committed to a good chunk of the nighttime stuff that's exterior, the exclusion of the courtyard at the end of the movie, which was on location in a quarry. But a lot of the like campfire stuff, them like camping out, the fight with Despairon, the Stone Man, all that was in studio. And yeah, I committed to this idea of like, just smoke it up, haze the hell out of it, have it just fall off into blackness, because that's just what these movies look like to me. Like, there's just something fun and otherworldly about it. And also, I'm just like, you know, you go out on location at night to shoot a night scene. It's like, what are you really getting unless you've got like, you know, lights on a lift, like cheating moonlight, and you're doing like these huge lighting setups, which we obviously could not afford. So it's like, if you can't do that, it's all falling off into blackness anyway. So we might as well just be in studio. So yeah, it was a conscious creative and budgetary and scheduling decision to like kind of split between studio and on actual locations.
Did you have someone specific in mind for the role of Deathstalker, and how did you land on Daniel Bernhardt?
I just had him in my head as I was writing the script, just kind of like just a thought in my head as I was writing. I had just watched him in Bloodsport 4, The Dark Kumite. And I remember at the time thinking, like, this guy has had a full, varied career. He's like straddles lines between like actor, stuntman, fight choreographer. Like, he's behind the camera, he's in front of the camera. I just felt like it just got into my head, this idea, like, oh, Deathstalker kind of was reflective of that a little bit, like older, wiser, been through a lot of shit guy. And so then that just kind of informed the script as I was writing it. And I just got fixated on this idea of Daniel playing the character. It just seemed like an offbeat, more interesting choice than just me trying to find a I don't know, just a kind of generic looking fantasy dude. And right. Yeah, I mean, we had a Zoom call. I met him like very early in the project. We hit it off instantly. And that was like a big turning point for me too, where I was just like, oh, he's like on board and he's already the mascot of this movie. Like he already really wants to do this. And also just the idea of like Daniel, like after 30 years of working basically in like smaller roles and villain roles and working behind the scenes, stunt work, fight choreography, like to have like a lead role like this again was really exciting. And just for all of us, just collectively being like, yeah, it's like this guy deserves deserves the spotlight and deserves to be the center of attention, this whole movie that's just kind of built around him. And so I got so fixated on the idea. I didn't even really consider anyone else. Like, I don't know who I would have gone with if he had said no. So yeah, he's just like this whole time, he's just been in my head as Death Stalker. Mm-hmm. And especially now, I'm just like, yeah, that's who he is. He's Death Stalker
yeah.
now.
Yeah, he's great in the movie, and it's a great pick. He's really, really good as Death Stalker. And did anyone give you any like, you got to include this in Death Stalker or that? It's again, it's one of those things I was talking about it as IP. It is IP, but like, I don't know if anyone's going to be like, well, I don't know. In the third, in Death Stalker 3, you know, like, did anyone get like kind of specific about things you needed to include, or they were like, just have fun?
Oh yeah, some people were like, well, you got to have tits in the movie because that's what those movies have. And I certainly got pushback from some people on that after the fact. But honestly, like once that conversation started, it just got so obnoxious that I was like, you know what? I'm going to commit to like, and here is my explanation. Whenever I get this question at Q&As, because there's always one fucking guy that asks me. So you look at that Death Stalker poster, mm-hmm. the Boris Vallejo artwork, and there's a big monster man clutching a busty lady, Death Stalker swinging a sword, and there's another monster in the background. We definitely get the busty lady in that movie. Do we get that cool troll monster man? No, we don't.
Right.
Nobody seems to be complaining about that, though. Like, these guys don't seem to take issue with that. So my logic was, how about I just basically four movies worth of missing monsters and magic and effects. I'm just going to cram those all into one movie.
Right.
And it, just to make up for the lack of through the rest of the franchise.
Deathstalker is kind of like, there's a series of posters that they don't deliver on basically throughout the entire franchise. Maybe the second one notwithstanding, but there's a lot of like posters that they do not pay off on it very much at all.
Yeah. And so like as a kid looking at those boxes in the video store, like I was excited. I thought like, oh, I'm going to have like monster action. This is cool. And sure, the TNA distracts you from that a little bit, but definitely anytime I watch them, I hit a point where I'm like, I kind of want like something fantastical to happen. And so, yeah, that's why I went with this approach of like, what if I just jammed it with monsters and action and put it more in line with the other fantasy movies of the era, something like Krull or Sword and the Sorcerer. So yeah, and so that was really the only thing anybody was like, oh, you should have this in the movie. Otherwise, I don't even think people would know what to ask for. Like
right.
And that's kind of why I gravitated towards it too, is I was like, there isn't really a mythology in place here that anyone's gonna be like, actually in Death Stalker 2 this happened.
That's like, what I'm waiting for that guy to be like, yeah. You know, Death Stalker 4, you know, like
I was hoping somebody would get mad at me calling the tavern Munkar's Tavern, because Munkar is the villain of the right. first movie. But my headcanon logic for it is that he had a brother who went legitimate and was like, okay, my brother is becoming an evil sorcerer. I don't see that panning out well. I'm going to start a business. And so he opened up a tavern.
Right.
And, yeah, Munkar is
the more practical brother. You got the dreamer brother, the more practical brother.
Yeah, that makes exactly. sense. So yeah, I was all prepared to give that explanation at a Q&A to an angry Deathstalker fan. Never happened, unfortunately.
Yeah,
So,
that's the
but
thing.
yeah.
It did offer you kind of a blank slate because there, I mean, I don't even know how, there's not a lot of people that have seen three and four, you know, myself excluded, but there's a lot of people that have not, have maybe didn't go past the second, or maybe haven't even seen the first two, or weren't even familiar.
There was a lot of people like at screenings. I would ask like, "Who's seen Deathstalker?" And like, maybe half the audience or less would put their hands up. I'm a little worried for some of those people, like who just came in off the street to watch this, relatively fun and benign fantasy movie, like to then go back and watch the first one. Like, I don't know if they're prepared for what they're getting into.
Yeah, right.
But I also, the shithead in me kind of likes the idea of that tonal whiplash knocking people around, because that's the video store whiplash that you get from renting stuff that you don't expect. Going in with one expectation, getting something else is always fun and part of the adventure. So.
Yeah, if somebody watches your movie and goes, you know, I should check out these Deathstalker movies at long last. Like the first one is definitely very different.
Yeah, in fact,
Yeah.
I had a friend that did exactly that. He texted me that he watched your Deathstalker and then he realized there was another Deathstalker from the 80s and started watching it and said, "Boy, it's really different." I said,
Yep.
"Yeah, it
Yeah,
is."
there. I remember the last time I had like a group watch of that movie. Me and a few of my effects industry friends watched it, and we were really clocking that like there's more moments of nudity in that movie than moments without, which is kind of insane. And also, and this is another reply to this whole complaint of not having nudity in the movie. When you watch, I make movies to watch in a crowd, as a group. You sit down with your friends, you watch these movies. Like when you're watching, say, the first Deathstalker, like if you guys sat down and watched it together and there's just breasts on screen for prolonged periods of time, like are you guys having a good time? Doesn't it feel weird? Like,
Little awkward.
yeah, exactly. So it's like, I don't know. That to me diminishes, especially the theatrical communal experience. Like I want people to be like reveling in the stuff happening on screen. Like I love at screenings I've been to, people are like cheering when monsters get dispatched. Like were people gonna clap when a lady takes her top off? Like is that culturally where we're at right now? So anyway, not to endlessly harp on that, but I mean, I've had enough questions from people at this point that it's definitely like in the back of my
Yeah,
mind. Like wonder, yeah.
I mean, if you watch a movie and then you're like, "Where's the nudity? Like, where's what problem? Where's the problem? Does it lie in the film or is it your problem? Do you have
I'd say both."
Yeah, I think, yeah.
What
But
a
then
take.
this, honestly, this is like a thing that has followed me and Astron 6, like since the beginnings of our movies, is you get lots of wonderful people who are fans and great to chat with. And then there's also like other weirdos that you're like, I don't know if I want you having my contact info. I don't know if I'm worried you're going to show up on my doorstep at some point in the middle of the night. Like movie fans can be wonderful, but they can also be fucking weird. So yeah. And that, and that's we're unfortunately in a genre where you get a nice healthy mix of everybody.
I You
mean,
mentioned that you were having you wanted people to watch this in a group, and you've gone to viewings of it and seen people cheer. Was there like a moment in the movie that like you really wanted it to land with audiences and they haven't reacted quite the way that you expected, whether that's good or bad or
I don't know. I mean, there's been l laughs that I wasn't expecting. Like when Deathstalker puts down the map for the first time, it always gets a big laugh because I guess because it's such a stupid, simple map that people are like, "Oh, okay, that's what this movie is. It's a silly movie." And I guess, yeah, typically in a fantasy movie like a Lord of the Rings, you get an epic, sprawling, beautifully drawn map with all these like elaborate names for everything, and then our map is just like X's over stuff and like beer, tavern, bugs, don't go there. So yeah, that every time I've watched it gets a big laugh. I was not planning it to be a laugh, but it is. So yeah, I'll say as far as like stuff like not landing, not really. I mean, there's definitely been like more subdued audiences, but that's standard. I mean, I've been at this long enough that every time I do the festival circuit of my movies, I've experienced like the highs and lows, the like zero reactions to the huge reactions. So
right.
that just comes with the territory at this point. I mean, I will say I've had some great audiences, like the Fantastic Fest audience, at that screening in Austin. They were cheering at everything happening in the movie, which I've never experienced before. Like they were just over the moon about it, which was really wonderful to experience. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Deservedly so.
I got to say, when I first watched it, just the minute the theme comes on and it's sort of the new version of the Deathstalker 2 theme, I was pretty pumped. I was so like, okay, yeah, this is going to be outstanding. And I mean, I had that feeling already, but I was just like, that theme song is just amazing.
The fact that we had that theme song at all, I was not expecting that to turn up. But that's another, speaking of things just magically lining up for this movie, that was a big one. Was obviously we had Slash involved. He had been associated with Raven Banner for a while, working as a producer with them. But him being friends with Bear McCreary and them teaming up to do a theme song, and then also looping in Chuck Sereno to like recompose his theme. It just kind of insane when that landed in my email inbox, just like, oh, here's like a new theme for Deathstalker and here's the guys who made it. It was, you know, in a movie full of like trials and tribulations and like just one speed bump after another, it was amazing to have like that bright spot of like, oh, well, we got this wicked theme song. Like it really just like livened everybody up, because it's like just such a great anthem to the film.
It's great. It's epic. Such a great. And what was it like working with Slash? I had read that he, once he got the script, he felt like you knew what you were doing. Was he hands-on at all? Was he sort of?
I mean, his big contribution was that song, but also he did do a little bit of guitar, like sprinkled throughout the score, like Blitz Berlin pulled him in to help do some of the scoring for that. Otherwise, it was really just like lending his name to the project to attract people. He came out to set for a day just to visit, which was really awesome. Like that was timed perfectly, because it was like halfway at least through production, if not 2/3 of the way. So like the crew, we were all getting pretty worn down and beaten up by this overly ambitious fantasy movie that we're grinding away on. So to have Slash show up on set and just like walk around and say hi to everybody and like sign autographs and get photos, and you could just see everyone's moods flip and suddenly everybody was like back into it again. So it was really nice to have him show up and show his support. And yeah, like he was just such a champion of the movie start to finish. It was really, really awesome having him, having just orbiting around the project in the way that he did. Really neat. And a thing that, like, not like I came into this being like, I want to make Deathstalker and I gotta have Slash on board. It was like, he wasn't like in my contract. It was like, no, he was just already kind of associated with these guys. And as the project grew and developed, he got more and more interested, and it just developed from there. It was really awesome.
Was Patton Oswalt always involved, or was that something that came about later?
No, that came about later. I mean, Patton and I have been orbiting each other for a while. He's attached. We've been shopping around a Psycho Gorman animated show, and he's attached to that as a producer. And so I've had a few Zoom meetings with him, and he's a Psycho Gorman fan, so he's a supporter of my work. And so, when this came up, he also has worked with Show Factory before, so there was like multiple connections, and it was a pretty easy thing to reach out to him about. And so, yeah, we booked him in a sound studio down in LA, and I was up in Canada on Zoom, and just did a marathon day of all of Doodad's lines. But yeah, he was amazing to work with, like total pro, super professional. I mean, yeah, like that guy knows what he's doing. He's been around forever. He's super talented. The only line he bumped on was the, "Did I do dad?" he really did not like that line, and he's ready to admit it publicly. But, you know, similar to the picture frame thing in Frankie, I pushed for it and I was like, no, I want at least one groan out of the audience in this movie. It should be here.
Yeah.
And so he begrudgingly did it, and I'm grateful to him for that.
So are we. Is the animated Psycho Goreman still in play? Is that still a thing that's possible?
I mean, it's in play in that we are shopping it around. It is not, hasn't been picked up, but we've taken meetings. People are interested. It's, you know, it's kind of a difficult time to get projects off the ground right now. There's a lot going on in the industry. A lot of uncertainty about stuff.
Yes.
So, people like buying original stuff is a bit of a tough sell, but we have an amazing team. Like, I love everyone involved, and we've got some great artwork done for it. The hope is, I think at a bare minimum, we're going to try and get a pilot or something going, but yeah, it's being shopped around. Nothing concrete yet, but yeah.
Maybe was that something you thought of doing instead of doing a Psycho Goreman sequel?
It was actually pitched to me by the team at this company, Five Successes. Kit and Lucy pitched this to me that like they have experience in animation. And so they were like, what if we love Psycho Goreman? What if we did it as an animated show? And the appeal of that to me was, oh, cool. I don't have to make anything. So, yeah. You know, I'm trying. I have to think strategically a little bit in my career. I can't physically make every single monster in all my movies all the time and shoot inserts in my basement all the time. So the thought of like, oh, somebody else animates it and does it, and I get to George Lucas it a little bit and like oversee it, very appealing to me. And so I'm entertaining all of those offers, because yeah, it's like I'm one guy. I have only so much energy. As much as I would love to do a PG sequel, a Frankie sequel, a Deathstalker sequel, it's like I gotta weigh those against paying the bills and also like how realistic is it to get one of those things off the ground. So when an opportunity like the PG animated show gets pitched to me, I'm like, sure, if that's a way to keep the IP alive and indulge other sensibilities of mine. I mean, I'm trying to like just fill all these holes of things that I wanted to see as a kid. And you know, the Psycho Goreman being like a tokusatsu family film, action sci-fi comedy, the idea of an animated spin-off makes perfect sense to me.
In the way
that like a Rambo animated spin-off or a RoboCop spin-off makes perfect sense, of like, oh, here's an R-rated property, why don't we market this to children?
So
it made sense to do that for PG.
Yeah, we discussed the RoboCop animated series because it was a New World television project. And it
I didn't realize that was New World that did that. That's crazy. Yeah. I was just watching the pilot like a week and a half ago.
Well, because New World owned Marvel in the late 80s. They owned Marvel Comics. Right. So
that's where Punisher came from.
Right? And they did like three Incredible Hulk TV movies. Yeah. And so they ended up doing a lot of animated shows into the 90s, and a lot of that was through Marvel. So they did the RoboCop one, which is a crazy thing to think about. I mean, like you said, it's an odd thing that became very popular with kids, the original RoboCop not being very appropriate, but
also that show like went harder than I was expecting it to. Like, it definitely goes harder than the Rambo show, which has the G.I. Joe problem of, it's like a lot of people.
No one dies.
Yeah, it's like guys shooting like this, like just kind of like spraying the air, and then people running away as like ricochets hit the ground. And like, yeah, maybe that's fine for a few action scenes, but at some point you need like cause and effect, like something has to happen. So, but yeah, RoboCop, I felt it got pretty intense at times, and somehow managed to still maintain a bit of the tone of RoboCop. I don't know. There's like a fun kind of like satire to it that I wasn't expecting. Like it almost did the satire a little better than say like, no, I shouldn't say that. I shouldn't say it does the satire better than RoboCop 2 because I'll get in a lot of heat for that. But I'm beefing with RoboCop 2 right now. So,
So RoboCop 3 had the like really difficult proposition of doing exactly what the cartoon did. So you can sort of put it up against the third one. The third one having to like be the one that was not R rated. So they wanted it to have more child appeal. And so you could certainly compare it to that one. I feel like nobody.
Yeah, that's
nobody
true.
Should.
I guess the animated show does feel more in line with that third movie. And then in turn, the series where it's like, it definitely feels neutered. Like it's something has been ripped out of it. You just can't like, and it's obviously it's the intensity of the violence to punch up the satire, I guess.
Sure. But going back to making creatures, you have been making creatures for a long time. You started when you were very young, doing these kinds of effects, and you made all the creatures for all of your movies, obviously in Deathstalker too. Didn't you also have to go back later in Deathstalker and add a couple extra monsters as well?
Well, because we split into two blocks, like we didn't get everything in principal photography, so we had to do an extra 5 days of shooting in the fall of 2024, and so that gave me time to build more stuff and rejig existing things, like the there's like a frog creature early in the movie, so taking that and making an evil frog, which we did because when we shot in the quarry for the climax, I guess it was like frog mating season or something. So there was just like frogs making frog sounds, like in and around, echoing off the stone walls of this quarry. And so audio was picking it up, and like our sound team was like, there's nothing we can do about this. You can just hear frogs in the audio. Unless you ADR this whole thing, you're going to have to live with it. So knowing this, when we went into block two, we built these evil frogs so we could shoot that establishing shot of like the Dreadite walking past these frogs just to establish like, oh, there's evil like red-eyed frogs in this quarry. So if you hear them on the soundtrack, that's why they're there. And so there's a lot of that, a lot of like, oh, we could use this moment to punch this up or tweak this. Like the Pigman death, his head getting ripped open, spoiler alert. Like I built that
incredible
in
effect.
Two blocks.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm very happy with how that turned out.
Oh, it looked awesome. Yeah.
Real fun, real satisfying too. I mean, it's like the ideal, even though it wasn't planned, it is the ideal way to shoot this kind of stuff where you have like 6 months in between to just jam out other effects. And even just like have an edit, like we had 2/3, 3/4 of the movie cut together. So I could watch that and go like, oh, we need this here, we need this here, we need this effect. And so, because yeah, I just find with effects movies in general, it's tough to be like, I know exactly what we need all the way through.
Right.
Things become so clear when you're sitting in the edit, you can go like, oh, like this moment needs to be bigger. This part that I thought we could cut away, I really would love to not cut away and show a gag. So yeah, it like having that helped us inform what we were shooting in block two. And then in turn, a few days of inserts after that, I think we did like 3-4 days at the effects shop, just shooting close-ups of like swamp guy stomping a guy's head. And like Joe Tack's arm growing back on the slab, like that kind of stuff. So, which is pretty typical Steve Kostanski movie stuff, where it's just me and like three other guys in a shop with a couple lights and a camera, and me puppeteering a thing under a table. It's like everyone just expects that at this point, but that's what we call rap on a movie in principal photography. It's not actually rap. It's like Steve and the first AD and the DOP are going to be shooting this movie for 6 months after the fact. So, yeah.
Yeah. You had do you have a bigger crew for this one? Cause I know for Frankie Frico, you had like a very skeleton crew, right? For that one. It was.
Yeah. I mean, the whole pitch for that one was like, can we make this for very little money? How tight can we keep this? How scaled back can we make this? So like we went into it with that intention and didn't really push back on it. Deathstalker, we clearly needed more people. Like we had like a camera, we also had a B cam going at the same time, especially for all the fight stuff. there's just so much to get. We needed crew for it. We needed a team, and also like the location work as well. Even things as simple as like, you know, Lori being a little person, like having to, you know, get her around the location was right. something, a logistical things we had to factor mm-hmm. in. So we needed to have somebody drive her between the, like the trailers and wherever we were shooting and back again, because you can't expect her to walk that distance. So yeah, it was just lots of logistical stuff like that, like just lugging bodies down into a quarry and laying them down and dressing blood on them. There's just huge, huge tasks that needed to be done that required more crew. So yeah, it was definitely a sizable crew compared to Frankie Frico, especially.
Yeah, which was a little bit more contained because you were kind of more contained on that set, but still a lot, still a huge task to do it with the amount of crew that you had.
Oh yeah, like Frankie is definitely a small movie by comparison, but still, like the fact that it was, we had a two-story set, like shooting in studio, like there was still lots of logistical stuff to navigate. It was just a different type of project, and it definitely right. made me, when we did Deathstalker and we were out on location up in Sudbury, it just felt so much more exhausting compared to Frankie. So then when we ended the shoot with Block 2, it ended. Block 2, where it was in studio in Toronto, it was like, oh yeah, this is right. We're back where I want to be, which is in studio with our sets. Everybody's in one big space. Like I can just like call out the name of somebody and they'll come running. I don't have to like go to the other side of a quarry to find somebody or to go to the bathroom. So it was nice to end it almost like in the way that we did Frankie, where it was a little more contained, a little more manageable, and just like, yeah, just achievable on a budget.
We've talked about your influence of being like in the video store and, you know, being influenced by movies like from Full Moon and Vestron. But you've actually worked with one of the companies that produced a lot of those movies with Troma.
Yes.
How was that experience? Can you talk about that?
I mean, I got to say that Adam Brooks, I think, bore the brunt of that relationship more than the rest of us. I had it pretty easy by comparison. I mean, we all went into Father's Day knowing that there was going to be next to no money. But this was like really no money. This was $10,000 Canadian to make Father's Day.
Wow.
Which like,
wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Stupid amount of money. It's kind of stupid of us to be like, great. Where do we sign? But it also is a testament to like the energy that you have when you're younger and you're like in university living at home and you don't have to worry about bills as much. Like I was just like, oh, whatever, like that's what we're doing. I was doing it at the same time as I was doing Manborg. It's like, yeah, I'll shoot two no budget features at the same time and work a job and have a life. That's fine. I just won't sleep, I guess. So yeah, I mean, it was like a crazy task to embark on. And yeah, Adam was the one who had to deal with Lloyd and what's the other guy? Michael Hertz.
Mm-hmm. Michael Hertz.
Name? Yeah. Yeah. He had to deal with those guys. And I mean, you're welcome to ask him at any time about that. I don't want to speak on his behalf.
Sure. Sure.
All I know is that, yeah, it was tough and we haven't worked with them since. So glean from that what you want.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly probably didn't want to race to make the next $10,000, you know, movie
no,
for them,
not.
You know. Yeah, but it was probably more money though than Manborg, wasn't that
yeah,
independent? I mean
Manborg
entirely
Manborg was basically no money. It was just my money, like whatever I had in my pocket at the time, that's what I spent on it. That movie is made out of garbage that I found. Like it's just I begged, borrowed, stealed. I borrowed my like old high school video camera to shoot it on, edited the whole thing myself, did all the post and stuff. So yeah, that's like the definition of a no budget movie. So Father's Day seemed ambitious by comparison. We were shooting it in HD, whereas Manborg I shot in standard definition, which is insane to think about. Like what's that? That's like 720 by 480 or something.
Yeah.
Like that's not even, is that even 1K? I don't know. It's terrible.
Not probably going to get a 4K at Manborg.
I remember at one point Arrow reached out about doing that, like just doing
really?
a, blue, about doing a Blu-ray of it. So, I mean, like, just in even just in HD. And I was like, well, I don't even have an HD file of the movie. But, no, maybe the technology's there to up-res it. I don't want to see what that looks like. I imagine it's not very pretty.
Yeah.
It's a movie that was meant for VHS. So, you know, that's where it can live. Or in your case, DVD in the background there.
I think the DVD looks pretty good, actually.
Oh, okay. I mean, there's, I did do like the opening title sequence, the end title sequence are HD. But then everything in between is standard definition.
Yeah. No, I think it looks pretty good. I absolutely love Divorced Dad as well. Like, that series is incredible. So,
oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I mean, that one I wasn't really involved with. That was peak editor days, which was when Adam and Matt and Connor were shooting stuff in Winnipeg, and Jeremy and I were out in Toronto. And so I wasn't really involved with that in any way. I think there was like one kind of like spin-off short that I helped Connor with. I don't even know if it's on that Blu-ray, but yeah, I mean, I love it, and I would love for them to bring that character back because awesome.
Very funny. But can you talk about how working with Astron 6? Like, I know you guys all met up because you were all doing shorts and putting them out on these festivals and just started working together. Can you talk about working with those guys?
Yeah, I mean, it all started because like we were living in Winnipeg, Manitoba at the time, like mid-2000s. I was making movies on my own, like doing stop motion shorts. I had become friends with Adam Brooks through a mutual friend. And he was sort of like mentoring me a little bit at that time. Like, there's a bit of a like older brother dynamic with him. He loaned me all these burnt DVDs of obscure genre movies to watch. And, you know, he was making his short films. I was making my stuff. And we'd submit to this local film festival that would happen every Halloween called the Winnipeg Short Film Massacre that Jeremy and his then girlfriend would run every year. And so at this film festival, we'd submit our little genre shorts at me and Adam. And it was there that we saw shorts by these two guys, Matt and Connor, out of Kenora, Ontario. So like, that's like a 2.5 hour drive from Winnipeg. And they were living in Winnipeg, going to school, making short films. And so everybody kind of met in around the festival. At first it was like kind of a competitive thing where it's like, I remember watching Adam and Matt shorts and being like, who are these guys? Like, are these guys my competition now? Cause you know, I was getting recognition for my stuff cause it was all like weird experimental stop motion stuff. And then Adam was just making really extreme, like gory, brutal stuff. And, Matt and Connor was leaning more into like comedy horror. And yeah, we started talking and, like Adam, I feel like Adam was the one to reach out and make friends with Matt and Connor. And then he sort of made friends with Jeremy. And then eventually we all just sort of became friends. And then the next year, when we were all making our short films to submit to this film festival, we started like helping each other out. Like I would do effects for Adam's stuff. Matt and Connor did voices on one of my shorts in St. Aphenia. And so we were all helping each other out. Then we were like, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we made a fake logo to go before all our movies? And that's like Jeremy and Adam came up with this Astron 6 concept and made an animated logo for it. And we were like, it'd be fun to just put this before all our movies. So then that year at this short film massacre, there's three shorts by all of us that all open with Astron 6, like the Astron 6 logo. And I remember people being confused, being like, are these all like the same guys? Like, who are these guys submitting these movies? And I don't know, just like, we just all clicked on that night in that window of time where we were like, yeah, let's just keep doing this. Cause like, clearly we all love making movies. We all love movies. We all enjoy hanging out. We all bring something different to the table, whether it's like acting, special effects, music, titles, writing. So we just all started working together and churning out these short films, and it just escalated to making features. And it just like was a crazy few years where it just felt like everything revolved around what's Astron 6 doing? What do we got going on? It was just fun to have like a collective, like a company where it's like, I'm doing this. There's like purpose now to what I'm doing. I'm not just making short films for me. I'm making movies. My movies are better now because I got these four other guys helping me out and they're all super talented. And I'm going to help them with their stuff and I'm going to do effects and things for their movies to make their movies better. And now all like collectively our movies are going to be the best movies in town. And we're just going to like, we're going to run the indie genre scene of Winnipeg, Manitoba. So yeah, that was like what, 2006 to like 2010, I guess, like 2010, 2011, like Manborg and Father's Day. And then, yeah, after that, we all sort of went our separate ways out of circumstance, like going to school in other provinces and things. You know, like life eventually just gets in the way and it stops being easy to make this stuff. But yeah, we managed to make Chow Boys, which is essentially the last Astron 6 short film. It was back in 2019 already. But that short played Sundance, which was like the biggest festival we've ever done, and somehow it got in there. And so, yeah, that was kind of like a nice big final hurrah for the Astron 6 experiment. Having said that, I still put the guys in all of my movies. Yeah, Adam, Matt, Connor have all appeared in Psycho Goreman, Frankie Frico, Death Stalker. So yeah, I mean,
Jeremy's not as willing to be in on camera, but he's great in Manborg, you know.
Well, that's what's so funny is like for a guy who's not doesn't consider himself an actor, he sure turns in a good performance. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's like we all help where we can, and yeah, who knows, maybe someday there'll be some Astron 6 thing on the horizon. But I know that we're all just pretty worn out from doing stuff for no money.
Yeah, sure.
Like, especially when you have families, like,
oh yeah,
most of us have kids and have real bills to worry about. It's like that idyllic period of no responsibility is definitely well behind us at this point.
Sure.
So it's hard to justify like, hey, what if we just drop everything and go make a weird movie?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I feel like I've definitely been putting effort in on my end to try and keep some stuff going with my projects and then forcing those guys in every way that I can. So,
yeah. I love it when they show up in your movies. They're always really, really great. Connor was so good and Frankie Frico and Adam is like practically, it steals Psycho Goreman. So amazing in that movie, and then just seeing them all sprinkled into Deathstalker was just such a treat. It's always welcome to see them all.
Yeah, I mean, I love that movie just becomes a Deathstalker's journey through Astron 6 land. Every few scenes, he's encountering a different Astron 6 guy. So,
right.
Yeah, it's fun being able to continue to torture them in different ways. Though I guess in the end, Connor got it pretty easy. He didn't have to do anything too torturous. Adam was the one who had it the worst. He had to lay on those rocks all day out in the sun. And yeah, it was bad. Bad for him. But yeah, whatever.
I mean, we're making movies, guys. Now, I got to ask this, though, and I'm sorry if you get asked this a lot, but I mean, do you think there is more to the BioCop story, or do you think that it's pretty much over? Do you think you've done all you can with BioCop?
I was just talking to my effects pal, Scott Patterson, who I've worked with on Deathstalker and a few other projects. And he's also works kind of in the indie genre space. And I was telling him, like, if you and your film buddies can get me a cop car, like a period appropriate cop car, I'll make more BioCop stuff. But I'll believe it when I see it. But if somebody can make that happen, then yeah, I would love to do more BioCop. I love that character. He's crazy. I'm a little confused as to what people think a 90-minute BioCop movie would consist of. I worry that it's just going to be like an SNL short stretched into a feature film where like at minute 70, you're going to be like, okay, it's like the shtick is pretty tired. Like maybe this should have stayed 5 minutes, but I mean, I would like to do something with him I mean, I forced him into Psycho Goreman.
Right.
I can surely find ways to put him into other movies somewhere. So yeah, he isn't dead because he can't die. So he'll just come back. He'll come back in his own pathetic way in some form.
I would love that. And I 90 minutes, yeah, I think would probably it would be tough, I'm sure. You would look with that with like joy and dread to try to put 90 minutes of BioCop, but I mean, where can I sign up? I would love to watch it. So, I mean,
okay. maybe we settle for like Frankie Farico's 84 minutes. Like that's a little more, palatable, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Whatever you got to do to the minimum feature length, you know, that's whatever you got to hit there.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just love that character. I love that you got him into Psycho Goreman, and certainly that was a great. But, you know, if you have more BioCop, that's amazing. That's amazing to hear. Mark, did you have...
Yeah, I was just going to ask that, you know, coming out of special effects and doing all the special effects that you've done, like, do you have advice that you give to, like, younger people that are doing special effects that they want to get into directing? They're like, I've been doing this. I want to take the next leap. Like... what advice do you give them to help them see how to take their career to the next level?
I mean, my big advice that I give to people is that you have to build a community on your own. Do not become the guy who has a script and is sitting on a script and is like, oh, if only somebody would make my script. Like, that's not a practical way to approach this industry, this very volatile and fickle industry that will turn on you in a second. Mm-hmm. So basically I'm trying to pitch to people, like, do the Astron 6 thing, meet like-minded people in the indie world who complement your skills. Like, meet people who know how to do cinematography, meet people who know how to do sound. Like, I don't know if that means like hanging around outside of film school or something, but like, the resources are all there. There's tons of people out there who want to be making movies. And the key is just, like, mobilizing a little force of people to do that with you and to achieve your vision. And if that also means, like, helping them on their projects, then so be it. Like, again, the Astron 6 model was the right way to do it because it allowed me to hone my skills by doing work for other people and then therefore being kind of beholden to their opinions and their expectations, but then also having them at my disposal when I needed the actors or crew or whatever to do music or titles or things like that. So yeah, it's like finding your people and putting in the time, putting in the effort to make it a reliable community. And that's how you get your shit made, and that's how you get your shit into festivals as well. Like, you start small and build up, especially if, like, your ambition is like, oh, I want to make a movie for, like, Shudder or Blumhouse or whatever. It's like, if you don't have a catalog of stuff already, nobody's interested. So you have to go out there and you just have to put in the work and get some stuff made. And just, you know, work your day job, put some money aside, like, maybe don't go out drinking and partying a few nights and sock that money away so you could pay a few film students $100 an hour, or sorry, like $100 a day or something to, like, come and help
$100
out.
An hour.
I was like, wait, hold on.
Yeah, hold on. That would have been... I'm not even getting there. But, like, you know what I mean? Like, just pay some people, like, an honorarium to help you out on your movie. Like, it's... I don't get it now when people are like, oh, I don't know how to get my stuff made. I don't have the money. It's like, there's always a way. I mean, when I had no resources, I was doing stop motion. Like, because I just wanted to create and I wanted to make stuff. So there's always... all that needed was, like, a camera and a desk and some little figures to animate. Yeah. Like, there's the tools are there. The resources are there. You can get your vision on screen in some way. And a good chunk of that is just having the drive to do it and not and just like being creative with how you execute it, I think is the most important thing.
Yeah, it's great advice. I guess one other question about Deathstalker. We loved the movie and we recorded an episode talking about it. And it seems like there was a clear creative vision on how this was going, how the movie was going to be, how it was going to play out. Was there anything in your, from writing it to directing it into post-production, did your creative vision change at all as to what you wanted to be? Or did you keep it like, I have a vision, this is the way it's going to go, and that's the way it ended up?
I mean, it went pretty much the way I anticipated it would go. It's surprising because, like, I'm always telling people, like, oh, you write one movie, you shoot another movie, and then you edit the third version of that thing, and they're all different. And I guess in small ways, you could say that about, like, Psycho Goreman, Frankie Frico, and Deathstalker. But really, all three of those projects, like, if you read the script and you watch the movie, it's, like, pretty much the same thing. Like, stuff got scaled back. There's certainly sequences in Deathstalker I had to come up with more creative ways to get across the same information. Like the sneaking into the graveyard originally was them hiding on a cart that the pig man was pulling, and the cart was full of bodies. So they're hiding under the bodies while the cart's going down the road. And then they're having their like interaction with Brisbane, with Doodad and Deathstalker, instead of them just going and hiding amongst bodies at the graveyard. So it was all like stuff like that where I maybe took an idea that was maybe a little more like it was a longer walk to get there, and I just shortened it. But the intention remained the same.
Yeah.
But as far as like the tone and just like the overall vibe of the movie, it's pretty close to what I wanted it to be. And I think a lot of that too is just like my creative team. I've really fortified myself with like my first AD, Scott Weatherall, my DOP, Andy Appel, my editor, Rob Hyland. Like those guys were really instrumental. And like also just some of the producers like Peter Kaplowski, a big champion of my work and always been supportive. These guys, it's like I just like put these guys around me and they just protect me from the bullshit and the people trying to like sway what the movie is. And
yeah,
like we're all on the same page and they all support my vision, but also bring their own interesting ideas and their personalities to the story as well. So it's not to say that I'm like everything I make, I'm like fixated on like, it has to be this thing. I'm very open to collaboration. And I just think I've got a good team of people who share like similar visions with me, and their creative visions, we all very much complement each other. Similar to like the Astron 6-5. It's like,
yeah,
everything they're doing is just enhancing what ends up on screen and is just building on the foundation that I start with the script.
And I have to imagine it's helped that you've done all these shorts and stuff too. So you've like made things so many times that to try to then, when you're making your movies, you've have the experience too, so that you yes. know what you can pull off for the most part, where you don't, sometimes you run into things where you're like, oh, I can't quite do that. But generally you have a good sense of what you can do and what you can at this point.
Yes. Like at the script level, from draft one, I was like, we got to get this horse out of the script as quickly as possible. That was, and
I love that scene when it runs off. Cause I wondered if that was like a production thing where you're like, yes, I got to get this horse out of here.
But it was like, I didn't even have like the producer conversation yet of like, we can't afford to have a horse too many days. Like I just, as I was sitting at my computer writing it, at that stage where you're supposed to be like, oh, the sky's the limit, right? Whatever. Already I was like, okay, like 2-3 scenes with this horse and then it's out of here, because I know where this is going and I just don't want the headache. I'd rather just do the real Roger Corman logic of have just enough scenes of it that you can pepper shots of it through the trailer. So right. People will be like, oh, this is like a big, real fantasy movie. And yeah, like, but just the exact amount. And then it's gone and you don't think about it.
Yeah. Definitely. Well, this has been great. We really cannot thank you enough for your time. We are such huge fans. I'm really such, I love your work and really You're doing what I feel like everyone says they we should be doing. Like, where are the original movies? Where are like the practical effects? Like, you're doing all of those things. So, I mean, I know it's every time it's a different kind of torture, but we really appreciate your work and what you're
Oh, well,
doing.
thank you. No, that means a lot. I really appreciate it. Thank you for having me on, and thank you for being supportive. I'm happy to see that you like have physical copies of my movies. That means a lot too, because like, yeah, I got a big collection. I love buying Blu-rays and DVDs and VHSs and laser discs, and you gotta keep that stuff alive.
For
For
sure,
sure.
for sure. And now I know you maybe can't exactly say, but do you know what you're doing next, or do you have an idea what you're doing next?
I mean, there's lots of conversations swirling around, but nothing is locked in. I certainly have like effects work lined up
Okay.
that'll pay my bills, so
Are you
I'll be
doing
doing some
like In a
stuff.
Violent Nature too, or you're doing one of those,
Yeah, I
or?
mean, we actually wrapped that up a couple months ago, so that's in the can already. That was kind of like, I guess we shot that September or October, and then yeah, there's a few projects lined up. Early next year that I'll be doing effects for. My hope is to kind of wind down now, maybe actually take a little bit of a break, maybe watch some movies and play some video games and recharge. I need to recharge my creative
Sure.
batteries a bit
You bet.
because yeah, I want to like I'm pretty burnt out and I want to get to that point of being passionate and excited about making movies again. And then I'll be ready to dive into another crazy, overly ambitious scenario that I'll be cursing myself for deep once I'm deep into production.
Well, whatever that is, we're excited for it and we can't wait to see it. So, thank you again and congratulations on Deathstalker and all your great work.
Awesome. Great chatting with you guys.
And that's it. That is our talk with Stephen Kostanski. Thank you again to Stephen for
Thank you so much.
joining us on this podcast, talking to us. I really do think like this guy is making the movies we all talk about and practical effects. He's got such a great sense of humor. I just think like, you know, he's making the movies that people talk about. Why don't we make more stuff like this? And this is the,
Exactly.
when I think of him, his movies, I'm like, we should be making more of this stuff. So
For sure.
thrilled that we got to talk to him. If you want to hear more of our episodes, including if you want to go back and listen to our episode about Psycho Goreman, which was a long time ago now, you can go to our website,
My voice was a lot higher back
newworldpictures.com.
then.
It was.
I talked sort of like this
Yeah.
back then, but then
You
my
went
voice dropped,
through
so.
podcast puberty, which
Yeah.
is a
It
unique,
was weird. It was uncomfortable.
it's like regular puberty, but just only in podcasts. You age only while you're podcasting.
I learned some things about myself
You
during
did. You
podcast
did.
puberty.
You made some
Yeah.
great strides. You've become a real great guy, Mark.
Thank you. I appreciate
We're all growing up. But you can go to our website, newworldpicturespodcast.com, and that's where you can find all of our episodes and interviews and t-shirts. Buy a t-shirt if you can. There's many different designs, and that helps support the show. Or you can tell a friend about the show, give us a 5-star review, any of those things. And we'll see you next time on the New World Pictures Podcast, a part of Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network. Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening. To hear more shows from the Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network, please select the link in the description.
Are you a film fan who loves the ultimate home video experience? Look no further than The Disconnected. Your host, Ryan Verrill, is your go-to source for the latest and most accurate information on home video releases, exclusive interviews with industry insiders and filmmakers, and has established a thriving community where every film and physical media enthusiast feels welcome. From hidden gems to blockbuster hits, The Disconnected brings you insider knowledge and a welcoming space to share your love of cinema. Watch every Thursday night at 9:30 Eastern, 6:30 Pacific for the live announcements show and follow The Disconnected on social media to stay updated. Subscribe to The Disconnected on YouTube or on the podcast provider of your choice and dive into a world where every movie night is an adventure.